Hey everyone, this is Zach Weiss, and I am joined today by Zach Kazan.
Hi.
And this week we are going to be doing a podcast sort of version, revision of our recent sleeper watches guide, which was called More Than Meets the Eye, a guide to sleeper watches. And before we get into that and what the topic means, let's start with a wrist check. So Zach, what are you wearing today?
I'm wearing a watch that's it's a new acquisition for me. I just picked it up this week, and it also kind of fits into this topic in kind of an interesting way, I think. It's
excellent.
Excuse my pronunciation. It's been a while since my high school French, but it's a Jaeger LeCoultre Memovox from the early 1970s. It has a large kind of sporty cushion style case. Obviously, it's an alarm watch, and I've kind of had my eye on, I've been interested in Memovoxes and alarm watches in general for a while, and I just really like this case. You don't really see it too often, and I found one in really good shape, and really happy to add it to the collection earlier this week.
Very nice. Congrats on the new, get.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was, you know, I saw a picture, obviously, on your account. It's a very different looking Memovox. I've never seen one remotely like that.
Yeah, so they JLC made Memovoxes in many, many different case shapes over the years, and this was definitely one of the sportier ones. These were marketed as speed beats for their high-frequency movements and more kind of like sporty appeal. So, yeah, just a really, really cool watch, and we'll obviously put a picture of it in the show notes, but very unusual case design. I feel like this is definitely something that I find myself gravitating to more and more. These sort of like unusual kind of oddball watches with interesting case shapes, especially when it comes to vintage watches. And yeah, really, really pleased with it.
Would you say, generally speaking, like because you're going for oddball watches that might not be as like immediately popular or collectible, that the prices are better?
Yeah, for sure. Watches that are kind of like less collected and less, you know, kind of like in demand, certainly don't command the, you know, the premiums of the, you know, just like more common or commonly desired, you know, vintage watches. Yeah, for sure.
And lastly, how is the alarm?
The alarm's a lot of fun. It's it's more of like a buzzing, you know, than a
a
chiming alarm. But it's you know, it's very obvious when it goes off. Playing with it's a lot of fun, and yeah, it's very, very charming and cool. I don't need the alarm complication, obviously, to keep me on time. But it's nice that it's there. I enjoy it.
That's excellent. Yeah, I've always found the alarm watches interesting. I don't know if I like have ever felt the pull for one, but yeah, I could just see if I had one playing with that probably too much and like annoying people or accidentally setting it off like that. Like it would go off, you know, at that moment of silence when no one's supposed to be talking. That's when I would accidentally have set it for.
Yeah, kind
of
for sure. I'm lucky. I live alone and I work from home, so I can only annoy myself here.
Perfect.
So.
Perfect.
Works out. What are you wearing?
I have on, I was thinking whether or not this qualifies, maybe we can debate that, but as a sleeper watch that is, but the Marathon Navigator Desert Tan case with the sterile dial.
Cool, very cool.
So, yeah, these are new to the shop, and couldn't help it, had to get one. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a really great summer watch. I actually had a black Navigator that I got years and years ago, and this is kind of sad, but you know, it, like the battery died at some point and I just never got a change, but it's sitting here in the office now because, I just, you know, when we were bringing them in, I wanted to take a look at it. And I remember wearing that a lot and really liking it, specifically in the summer, like looking at it, I can see like how it was, I wore it a lot. It was very like crusted with, you know, sweat from the summer. And so this is bringing back some memories, because it is a very comfortable watch, like it's because of its lightweight case. And to me, maybe, you know, there's some sleeperness there because of the fact that it's mil-spec and has tritium tubes, but, you know, I mean, literally has no name on the dial or anything. And is plastic case. I mean, it's a special plastic, but it, you know, to somebody who doesn't know better, it could almost look like a toy. You know.
Yeah, I think that qualifies as a sleeper. I mean, anything with a sterile dial is kind of a sleeper, because you just, you know, you literally kind of like don't know what it is at a glance if you're not like super familiar with watches. And the fact that it's, you know, like a plastic or composite case and mil-spec also, I think, kind of lends it some some sleeper cred, if you will.
Definitely, definitely. So we might as well just jump into it. So what is a sleeper watch?
So I think a sleeper watch is any watch that has some sort of feature or attribute that is not obvious upon like first glance, at least when it comes to modern watches. When I put the guide together, I wrote about talking to Eric Strickland for part of the Ask the Collectors podcast series that we're doing. And he's a, you know, kind of a big proponent of this idea of sleeper watches. And a lot of his watches are vintage watches. He's a great vintage collector, and he's collected watches over the years that are kind of been like lost to time and like kind of unfairly maligned, I guess you'd say. And he you know, puts it much better in our conversation, which is, you know, coming in that series. But, you know, in the context of a modern watch, I think, you know, you can look at sleepers as just watches that have some sort of like feature or benefit that isn't readily apparent.
I always think of that, you know, that feature. So yeah, it's not apparent, but I think it's always like, it's something kind of exceptional or special, or something that you would maybe assume is very expensive. And I guess in some instances, the watches still are expensive, but they're not flaunting that aspect of it.
Yeah, something that's like under the radar, that's not, that's just not like super obvious. Like things that other watches might, you know, promote very strongly, you know, either in their, you know, marketing or whatever these watches have, just kind of like, you know, you know, like I said, it's under the radar. It's a little less, over the top.
Yeah. And we, for this guide, kind of went for more like horological features, I would say, than toughness features. So they tend to have to do more with the movement, maybe some craft aspect. But, you know, I think there's the other version of a sleeper is like, you know, a super tough watch you just don't know is tough, which maybe is sort of kind of relating the translation from like the car side of a sleeper, you know, I feel like. Sure. But since we talk about tool watches so often on the site, it seemed like a nice change to go for the more like horological. So let's just kick this off, because I think the first watch in here is really an excellent example of a sleeper watch. Hence why it's in here. So the Tissot Gentleman Powermatic 80 Silesium. Can you tell us about that watch?
Yeah, so we linked to our review of the Tissot Gentleman that ran earlier this year in the guide, and it's a you know, on the surface I think it's a pretty, I don't mean this in a negative way, but it's kind of a generic looking watch. It's just sort of like, you know, like something that we say, you know, fairly often. It's like what you would conjure in your mind if you imagined a watch. It's just sort of like, you know, very simple and basic. And that's I think a desirable thing to a lot of people, but the movement is pretty special. It's essentially a tricked out at a 2824 with a longer power reserve and some silicon components to give it a kind of a little bit more anti-magnetism and durability over time. And that's, you know, it's on the dial. It's you know, it's called the Powermatic 80 Silesium. So it's, I guess, not a sleeper in that sense. It's advertising those features right on the dial. But this is a watch that costs less than $1,000 and has what, you know, maybe like a decade or so ago would be considered like some pretty high end and expensive features. So it's, I think, a good example of how, you know, some of that tech has really like trickled down into the value end of the spectrum.
Yeah, definitely. And it's very cool, because I mean, Silesium has gone from like exotic to mainstream. I don't know, mainstream is quite the right word, but like mass produced is better. Like even in a very short amount of time, enough time that like I've watched it do this as part of the watch world. And you know, like you said, like around a decade. I think the Lycée Nardin Freak might have been the first watch with like a.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
And I'm not 100% sure when that first came out. Obviously that watch costs a lot of money for other reasons as well, but like the fact that they had like a, you know, a serially produced silicon hairspring was, I think, a really, really big deal at the time. And to go from that level of watchmaking to, yeah, like you said, essentially an ETA 2824, just kind of the house brand version of it that has been juiced up to 80 hours of power reserve, is really exceptional. And it's very cool. And it's, you know, kind of speaks to a slow but real progress in the kind of modernization of watches and watch movements. And the fact that all that is wrapped up in this very subtle, there you said, like kind of plain, as you put, you know, under $1,000 watch is really awesome. And, you know, and also to the watch's credit, like, you know, when you're looking at the review, it's also like actually a really, really beautifully finished watch for the price point as well.
Yeah,
like it's
for
really,
sure.
It hits above its price point in many respects.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the Ulysse Nardin Freak. You know, if that is in fact the first, you know, watch with silicon components, to look at the way that we've come from that particular watch, which is very avant-garde, to mm-hmm. something so traditional with the Gentleman, kind of, you know, illustrates just how much more mainstream that sort of watchmaking has become.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very cool. It's like, I feel like they also didn't really push it as much as maybe they could have, like, in terms of, I don't know, I just remember when I was at Baselworld and, you know, Tissot, like, handed us a watch and they're like, you know, this one has a silk on a hairspring. And I'm like, wait, what? You know, and yeah. Then, like, it was a story, but it didn't seem to, like, kind of hit as big as, like, I feel like it should have. So, you know, I'm just happy that we get to kind of push it a little bit further, because this is the kind of stuff that, it, I don't know, makes me very excited.
Yeah, no, same. It's very cool that you have this sort of tech at this price range, and it's an appealing watch, you know, just kind of on its surface as well. You know, like, again, like, saying it's generic is not a slight on this watch. It's mm-hmm. You know, it's really well executed for what it is, and you know, great bang for buck at under $1,000 for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another watch, very different in its internals, but actually the one that is featured in the guide is kind of similar looking to the Tissot in many ways, but that is the Citizen Chronomaster. So what is a Citizen Chronomaster?
So Citizen Chronomaster is, you know, essentially a very high-end Citizen watch with a very high frequency, highly accurate quartz movement. Mm-hmm. So the reason we put this in the guide is because, you know, in the realm of high accuracy quartz, Grand Seiko gets a lot of press. We talk about Grand Seiko a lot, and their 9F movement, and Citizen has a movement that is very similar in terms of specs and what it's able to do in you know, a really beautiful, well-finished premium watch. It's a brand that is, we don't often associate, I think, with premium, you know, high-end watchmaking, but the Chronomaster definitely is that. And there are mm-hmm. multiple versions of the Chronomaster. The one that we have a photo of in the guide is kind of a you know, very well executed but simple version of the watch, but they've released special editions with the washi paper dials, mm-hmm. Which are really amazing. I don't know if you've had a chance to see those in person, but they're just absolutely incredible to look at. And it's definitely a watch that's kind of under the radar. It's a sleeper in the sense that it's just not as well known, I think, at least in the United States. Yeah. These watches are, I believe, still fairly hard to get in the U.S. I think you kind of have to be lucky, you know, walking into the New York Citizen boutique. They sometimes have them, or you can, of course, import them from Japan. But this one's kind of a sleeper in the sense that it's just not well known among enthusiasts here to a large extent.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, I actually did get to see one in person at the Chicago meetup we did several months ago.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, just you know, a guy had one there, and it was, you know, it was in a bar. It was kind of a dark bar, so it wasn't like the greatest place to look at a watch that has details like that. But yeah, it's very cool how they construct the dial with a paper substrate and then like a floating kind of crystal over it with everything on it, so you get this this sense of all the markers and everything hovering over this kind of nice paper texture, which is also kind of interesting when you can think of that as compared to the way Grand Seiko does their dials. Like, both have this very kind of poetic sort of feel to them, but one of them is using an actual material. The other one kind of, you know, they change their dial textures to emulate things.
Right.
So I bet there's a rivalry there for sure. I mean, I know there is between the two brands, but I bet like in that exact way, there's a rivalry. It's like,
yeah, definitely.
And you know, in Citizen, they also came out with that watch, which is not a sleeper because it doesn't, I don't even know if this has made it to any kind of production, but the Caliber 0100 from Baselworld a couple years ago, which is accurate to within 1 year, or what, sorry, within 1 year. I'd hope it's within, within 1 second per year, which is, you know, insane. And yeah, I think that that was definitely their kind of like attempt to sort of own that, the HAQ sort of segment. But yeah, I mean, I think HAQs are really interesting, and I'm getting this sense like there's definitely a little bit more of an uptake in the enthusiast community for them, you know, a bit through Grand Seiko, but then, you know, through some other watches, and I know of some watches that are coming out that are experimenting with it, and like, it's a very cool alternative to all these same mechanical movements that we're seeing all the time.
Yeah.
And obviously far more accurate than a mechanical movement. So that's really, you know, kind of exceptional also.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of high accuracy quartz. I, you know, I've talked about it, you know, many times on the, on the podcast, but I own a Grand Seiko with a 9F derived movement. And, it's just, it's wonderful to own. It's, you know, very satisfying to know that you have, you know, a movement that's kind of like at the top of its class.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Grand Seiko and also Citizen at this level, you're getting something that's like also exceptionally well made. It's not just like a really great like quartz movement with, you know, like, you know, the circuitry and everything. It's like still very satisfying as a watch, you know, aesthetically, in the way that, you know, we enjoy watches. You know, we want something that's like nice to look at and nice to hold and feel on your wrist. So when a high accuracy quartz watch is really done well, I think it's it can be incredibly satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, excited also to see where that kind of technology goes. I hope they continue developing it, not just Citizen and Grand Seiko, but other companies as well, because I mean, hopefully it's not too limited in what it can do and who can use it. All right, the next watch, I would say it's a touch controversial, a tiny bit. And it's also a watch that everyone knows is super familiar with, which is why it's maybe a little bit controversial. Because if you're in the know, it's not really, it's perhaps not a sleeper, but I feel like in spirit it is, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So that is the Tudor Black Bay 58. So for the one listener who's never heard of that, can you take us through?
Sure. Yeah. So this is a sleeper, or at least I think you can make the case for it being a sleeper based on the movement. So it's a, you know, as we all know, it's a, you know, Tudor now uses in-house movements. They switched to in-house a few years ago. They added an in-house caliber to the original Black Bay, or excuse me, the North Flag was the first Tudor with an in-house movement. And it's just kind of like they've gradually been adding them into their other watches as the years have gone by. So when the Black Bay 58 came out, in order for that watch to have the dimensions that they were after, they needed to create another movement, another in-house movement, you know, to achieve that smaller case size. So it uses the MT5402 caliber, which is essentially, you know, built like their other in-house movements, but just in a smaller size in order to achieve that smaller case shape, which is the whole point of the 58. So up until a few weeks ago, this was the only watch to feature that movement. Now, obviously, we have two Black Bay 58s. The navy blue one was just released. So, you know, in that sense, I think it's kind of a sleeper that it's a very like mainstream watch with a, you know, very large appeal, but just one watch with this in-house movement, which of course takes, you know, years of research and lots of money to for any brand to produce. So I just think that's kind of an interesting, you know, interesting way to look at the 58.
It's sort of like a sleeper within the Tudor collection. Like if you were to, once again, go to the sort of car analogy where you have the like bigger ones, which are like these clear kind of muscular sports cars. And then this little nimble thing comes out with the same engine in it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good comparison, I think.
It's also a hell of a movement, which I feel like people do gloss over because they're so caught up in the aesthetics. You know, the MT5402 on top of, well, on top of, let's first take a step back. Like Tudor is a sister brand of Rolex, and Rolex is, last I checked, a pretty trusted, respected name in the world of watches.
Yeah.
Sure. So if they make it, I think it's probably going to be pretty good, pretty reliable. So the Tudor is their sister brand, and while I don't believe they're manufactured in the same facilities, I don't quote me on that. Clearly there's similar technology, R&D, and the same body behind them. So the MT5402 is a 70-hour chronometer with a silicon escapement and free-sprung balance and like a full bridge balance over the balance spring. Didn't sound right. A full bridge over the balance spring. you have a lot of things going on. There's 70-hour power reserves. That's a really nice length for power reserve. Anything kind of over 40 starts to feel really good when you're like in practice. You know, you take it off for 2 days, you put it back on, it's still working. Always great. It's a chronometer, so it's gone through, you know, the COSC to be rated to, within 99% accuracy, but that's like ±4, -6 seconds a day. So that's a really nice accuracy. And anytime I've put one of these on a time grapher, granted we don't have like a professional time grapher setup or anything like that, they've read like almost flat zero. They're very well tuned. And then they have a free sprung silicon balance. So as we said before, like silicon making its way mainstream. Here you have a watch that's $3,700. So it's a little bit less surprising to see it. But once again, a few years ago, that wouldn't have been the case to even have it in a watch like this. So it has natural like anti-magnetic properties, natural, movements with silicon parts need less lubrication, which is longer intervals between servicing, all that good stuff. And then the free sprung balance. So it's like a weighted oscillating balance. So that's like tuned by a watchmaker. And those are less susceptible to, I believe, like variation in from shock than one with a traditional, regulator. So like all that good stuff is packed into a smaller, body and then put on your wrist. So like, to me, like that is an extremely cool thing. And when you just see a Black Bay 58 on someone, it just looks like a very understated classic dive watch.
It's an amazing movement. Tudor, I think you're right. Like Tudor doesn't get enough credit for the quality of the movements that they make. I have a Pelagos, and you're exactly right about the accuracy. It's spot on. Like every single time I check it, I haven't had that watch. That's another relatively new addition for me, but I haven't had to like reset it in like the month or so that I've had it. It's still within like just a couple of seconds, per day from what I can tell. So Tudor makes a great movement. I think it's really cool that for so long, they only produced this one watch with this particular movement. Now they have another one with the blue 58, and just a super high quality product in a lot of ways that they don't often get credit for.
Yeah, and a very good price for all that.
Yeah,
in the scheme definitely. Of things. So, well, I think we proved it. I think it fits. So
yeah, we can say. If you disagree, there's comments on the website and Instagram.
But be nice, please.
Yeah, please.
Okay, let's move on to the next watch. It's one I'm quite fond of, and I feel like it doesn't get the credit it's due within the collection for the brand that it's a part of. That's all very strange way to say it. But the Nomos Mini-Matic. This was the first watch to have the Neomatic movement, but I feel like it got sort of like lost in the shuffle with all the other ones. So can you tell us a little bit about this watch?
Yeah, so the Mini-Matic is, like you said, it was the first watch to introduce Nomos's new in-house automatic movement. And this watch to me is all about its like thin profile. So yeah. Nomos, we're all, familiar with Nomos. They make, or at least at the start of the brand's history up until relatively recently, they were kind of known for making thin, manually wound, pretty traditional styled and sized watches. And this watch, I think, is kind of like a bridge between like early Nomos and what we have now, which is, you wrote a review of a much sportier, Nomos that uses a movement derived from this one, a very thin automatic caliber. But it's in an effort, I think, to maintain that slim case profile, Nomos developed a very, very thin automatic movement. And this was the first watch that we saw it in. It's I believe the case is 35.5 millimeters. I could be wrong about that on the Mini-Matic.
It's a very small watch, but in a very appealing way.
Yeah. And so it's, this is a watch that if you looked at it from the side, you would guess that it's probably hand wound because it's so slender and it looks like a hand wound watch, I think. And it's a Nomos, so you would almost expect it to be hand wound, but the movement is really, really well engineered and well designed. And it sort of, you know, it's kind of set them on the course that they're on now, making, you know, they've obviously put this into many other watches or movements derived from this one into many other watches, and they've kind of kept that slim profile with, I think, what are more appealing watches to the masses with mm-hmm. with automatic movements.
It's actually, it's 33.5.
Okay.
According to the measurements I put there, which I hope are correct, but it was a very small watch, and I kind of feel like that might have been why it didn't, it maybe kind of got lost in the shuffle when it first came out, is I think it was accidentally sort of getting mislabeled as a women's watch rather mm-hmm. than, you know, as a unisex watch, which I'd say, you know, Nomoses generally are. But when I did get a chance to review it, I just found them like such exceptionally charming watches. And, you know, Nomos has all these, you know, handful of lines of watches. I'm not going to name them all now, but they tend to stick within those. And then every once in a while, they create a new line. So like the mm-hmm. Metro shortly before this, and then the Metro did quite well, so they've expanded on that a lot, and that has, you know, like a wire lug case. This one is also an entirely different design that is much more like modern and sleek than some yeah. of their other cases. It's really curvaceous, and the bezel, it's a three-part case. All other cases are two-part. The bezel sits in the lugs in a really elegant way and has a domed crystal. But they haven't done anything with it since this first launch. Yeah. So I kind of wonder what the deal is. But it's looking at it again, like I absolutely just love the look of this watch. But yeah, it is like, you know, thinness is an interesting characterization that, you know, in this instance is giving it that sleeper credibility. But it functionally, you know, it's something that I personally really like. Like we talked about a few weeks ago, like what we'd love to see in movements, and my choice was thinner because
yeah.
a thinner watch just wears better for like an everyday watch. You know, the other example used is the Nomos Trendente Sport that I reviewed. Like they beefed that up because that watch itself needed to be beefier to make sense. But, you know, for a watch you're going to just, you know, strap on and wear every day to the office, and, you know, maybe you're not ever going to cliff dive with it. That's my go-to example for like things you do with sport watches, which I don't know why anyone would.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that you might just decide to do one day.
You're walking.
You better be wearing a watch that can handle it.
Yeah, exactly. So this isn't the watch for that, but I mean, for everything else, it you know, it's the kind of watch that fit really that just would wear so well. And yeah, it's automatic and super thin.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a really beautiful watch. I had a chance to try one on shortly after they were released, and it's a little small for my mm-hmm. wrist. Although I definitely think that Nomos is in that like 35, you know, range. Generally, are you know, pretty safe to wear, you know, on almost any size wrist because of those long lugs. But on this one, because of that, like, more, you know, as you said, curvaceous design, it's it wears a little bit smaller than mm-hmm. similarly sized Nomos watches. But yeah, I'd be curious to see if they, you know, would ever update this line. I'd be interested to see what other kinds of either dial variants or size adjustments they might make to it.
Yeah, I mean, considering they're not shy you know, of making one watch in 20 different sizes, even if those sizes right. are like 0.5 millimeters different from each other. Yeah, I feel like this one is just begging to have a 35 and a 38 version.
Yeah,
as well. Okay, let's getting back to some movements with like you know, some accuracy and more kind of robust feature sets. We have two watches in here that actually do kind of, they have very similar specs on paper, very, very different movements, but very different like feature sets. And those are the Baume & Mercier Clifton Baumatic and the Christopher Ward SH21. So actually one is a movement, the other one's a watch, but here we had it featured in the Christopher Ward featured in the Grand Malvern mm-hmm. watch, which is still one that they make today. They've had many different watches with this movement. Some have come and gone, but this one has stayed core to their collection. So can you tell us a bit about the Clifton Baumatic first?
Yeah, so the Clifton Baumatic is a it's a 5-day chronometer, and or I should say it uses a 5-day chronometer movement. The mm-hmm. Clifton Bowmatic is a, you know, pretty conservatively styled, traditional, you know, kind of like dressy watch. And it's similar, you know, also in some ways to the Tissot that we talked about at the, mm-hmm. at the start. It's, you know, like on the surface, you would not look at this watch and think, like that has like crazy tech behind it. It doesn't scream, you know, like modern watchmaking, but it uses silicon components, and it has you know, extended power reserve movement, and it does that in a you know, in a watch that's still, you know, fairly affordable and represents a good value and kind of like an entry point into, you know, like a you know, Swiss brands with real heritage.
Yeah, I remember when this one came out being really surprised and impressed by it, because I mean, Bombardier doesn't often make watches that I personally find very appealing, and that's not meant to be like a shot at the brand. It's just a stylistic thing, you know. I feel like mm-hmm. they have a certain conservative kind of older style that just doesn't appeal to me per se. But this one, I mean, just on an aesthetic level, I liked it quite a bit, particularly the one that we featured in the article with the crosshair dial. Like, I think mm-hmm. that's just a very, very nice look. But then to drop this very impressive movement in a sub 5,000. I think that they start just below 3,000.
I think you're right. I think they're like 2,500 in that range, I think.
Yeah. Because yeah, we featured one in one of our 10 guides, our 10 great watches guides. For everyone listening, we do so much stuff. It's very easy for us to forget all these little features. We look at watches all day. So
also the Bowmatics do have, like, there are several different, like, kind of levels. Like you mentioned the chronometer, or excuse me, the crosshair. That's a feature of the chronometers only, yeah. I believe. So like you can get it without the chronometer certification for less. And you know, there are, you know, different dial variants that might have different price points. So, but yeah, it is hard. It's hard to keep all these things straight. Sometimes
it's my brain scrambled, but it's just you know, so anyway, but like for a Richemont Group brand to have this 5-day movement chronometer or otherwise, but an in-house movement, you know, at this price point was really exceptional, because they're, I mean, frankly, the kind of, you know, brand that would have a Salita SW300 or something at this price point as well, you know, that wouldn't mm-hmm. be shocking. So this was just really exceptional. So I think it's also a sleeper in that right too, that it's like an in-house Richemont movement brand. I mean, that might be kind of a little more inside baseball, but it's still like a cool feature you can kind of, like, you know, hold a little pride with, you know.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
And then next is the Christopher Ward, which, you know, so the features that these two have in common are that they're both 5-day chronometers. The Christopher Ward, though, does come in at a starting price that is well below the Baume-Mercier, but they are a direct-to-consumer brand, so that is to be expected. But can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, so like you said, the movements share, you know, some qualities. They're both 5-day power reserves, they're, you know, chronometer rated. I think this movement's interesting just because of what it means to the Christopher Ward brand, and mm-hmm. I touched on this in the guide. It really kind of, I think, takes them to a different level. This is a brand that, you know, when I got started, when I, you know, my first memories of this brand are as a kind of a, you know, a brand that made, like, very good, well-regarded dive watches primarily that, you know, could be considered homage watches by some. And mm-hmm. if you, you know, consider where they were, you know, just relatively short time ago and where they are now with this, you know, really fantastic movement that has been expanded. And, you know, we've seen them add, you know, modules, you know, for complications and other things to this movement with, like, really unique, interesting designs. It really kind of tells the story of how far the brand has come. And I think that's really, really interesting and worth highlighting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And when these first came out, I mean, you just said it here in 2014. I mean, that was, you know, that was several years before the Tudor Black Bay. That was several years before the Baume-Mercier we just talked about. So there weren't in-house movements from, you know, large, well-known luxury group brands in the 3 to 5K range, let alone in the price point that Christopher Ward is making theirs and still making theirs. Mm-hmm. And it's it was proven not to be just like a shot in the dark either. Like, they're making it this many years later. They are very good. Movements are very well respected. If you actually listen to the interview I did with Mike France, which is another podcast, you know, he talks a little bit about the fact that after, you know, you don't really know how good a movement is until you've had it out there for a few years. And they're very proud of the quality of that movement. It is a very reliable movement. And it's also just, it's an excellent looking movement. It's very big. I don't think they have it in watches that are under like 40, 41 millimeters. And while, you know, as much as I'd love to have like a 38 with it, the flip side of that is when you look at one of these case backs, there's just a lot of movement to kind of like sink your teeth into, including like two really massive barrels, which, you know, account for that full 5 days of power reserve, which, you know, I think we didn't even touch on, you know, I said before 70 hours is nice, but like 5 days is a week. You know, that's an awesome power reserve. So yeah, I mean, when this came out, it's like, you're looking at what else had an extended power reserve like that, like IWCs and Panerais.
Yeah.
And those were well over $5,000.
You're right. That it's a good looking movement. I like the skeletonized rotor too. So you can like actually see like the whole movement, even with the rotor taking up half of it. So, but yeah, it's good to know that like they've proven to be reliable, you know, over the time since they were introduced. It's definitely a good sign. And yeah, it's a very, very cool, very cool movement.
So I think that's a good segue to the next watch, which I mean, as you can tell, all these watches have cool movements, but I particularly fond of the movement that is in the next one. And this is the Grand Seiko SBGY003, which is a spring drive. So do you want to take a stab at what a spring drive is?
Oh man. I didn't know we were going to have a pop quiz podcast. So basically a spring drive movement uses a traditional mechanical gear train to power the watch, but uses quartz technology to regulate the timekeeping. It doesn't have a traditional escapement at the end of that gear train. It uses a proprietary Grand Seiko circuitry and a glide wheel to you end up with a highly accurate movement with a lot of the qualities of a traditional mechanical watch.
I think that That pretty much covers it. We have a video also on the site that we work with Grand Seiko on that goes into greater depth. So if you want to know even more about it, but yeah, that's the gist. It's sort of the best of mechanical, the best of, and the qualities of quartz that you're looking for or that you want, which is the level of accuracy obtainable. No batteries to switch. No circuit boards to really look at. There is an integrated circuit board in there, but you don't see it if you look at the case back. And then the watches themselves are almost always very high end. So this specific model, the SBGY003, is my personal favorite. And I think the most sleepery of the group. Do you want to talk about the watch itself?
Yeah. So I'm also a really big fan of this one. I think we're fans of it for the same reason, and it's because it takes away some of the things that make a traditional spring drive movement, which is kind of a sort of an oxymoronic thing to say, because the spring drive is anything but traditional. But you know, spring drives are historically automatic movements, and you have the very distinctive kind of like at this point signature power reserve indicator on the dial. A lot of people are not really big fans of that. It throws off the symmetry of a dial. And what Grand Seiko's done with the Caliber 9R31 in this particular watch is they've gotten rid of the power reserve on the dial and moved it to the back of the watch, and it's hand wound. So you have a thinner movement in what is a much more traditional kind of dress watch. This is a watch that's in the Grand Seiko Elegance collection, which is a relatively new collection for Grand Seiko, but is essentially their dress watch collection. And it's just a much cleaner dial, and you have all the benefits of a hand wound movement as well, plus the benefits of spring drive accuracy and just the other qualities of spring drive, which is just that it's cool that it's a spring drive. If you're into if you're into that at all, we don't have to explain why spring drive is cool. It's just a really interesting technology.
and highly accurate. I think they're within 15 seconds a month, something like that.
Yeah.
Which is pretty exceptional. They also have the distinct feature of having completely smooth gliding second hands,
right,
which is like hypnotic. It's almost like off-putting at first because you're used to that little bit of a tick or vibration in a sweeping second hand, and this is just perfectly smooth, and that's because of the way the glide wheel works.
Yeah.
This watch is utterly gorgeous. If I had $7,500 or whatever it is it cost when it came out, like I wish I could have bought one of these. It was a limited edition, at least in steel, and it's been gone for a while. Not that I've actually been in the market for it, but I've seen one on a wrist in the metal in New York City. Actually ran into a worn around reader, recognized me at a bar, and he had it on, which was awesome. And he showed it to me, and it just, like, on the wrist from a distance, it like looks like a vintage Seamaster or something like that.
Yeah.
It's so understated and so elegant. The fact that it has this really cutting edge technology in it, plus all the Grand Seiko craft, is just it's why it's here. You know, it's why it's a sleeper for sure.
Yeah, it's great. They made this watch in precious metals, well. And I believe the platinum one has an even more high tech spring drive movement with, we'll put it in the show notes, but it does something. It has a feature that keeps it continuously accurate at all levels of the power reserve, I believe. So,
oh, interesting. I didn't know.
Yeah.
That.
It's just even more wild than this one.
Interesting. So that's sort of their take on like a constant force of thing. Interesting. That's okay. I have to go read about that. That's really cool. And the other thing, like in general, any movement that has a dial of some kind on the back, I want. Like I've never had a watch with that. I mean, there's not very many out there, especially in the price point that we typically cover, that has like a power reserve on the back or occasionally. Yeah. I mean, yeah, occasionally you see wilder things like that, like, you know, a leap year indicator. But
yeah,
then
like calendar stuff, yeah.
Yeah, which implies also a really higher level of watchmaking. But, you know, I really love power reserves, but I don't think it needs to be on the dial. But the fact that it's still there is just, it's just like, just so cool.
Yeah, I typically wouldn't be interested in having, you know, like a power reserve on the dial. It's not something that, like, you know, is appealing to me. It's useful for sure, particularly in a hand wound watch. But I actually don't mind the power reserve on spring drive dials, just because it's like so distinctly spring drive. Like I said, it's kind of like a signature for them. But this watch works better without the power reserve. I think it just, you know, that would just throw off the symmetry, obviously. And it's very cool that they put it on the back. And I hope they make more watches with this movement, because there's definitely a market for it, at least between the two of us. I think, you know, we'd each be interested in a new watch with this movement.
Very much so. Very much so. So next up, let's move to the one FU watch in this list. And we don't typically have watches at this price point, but, for the concept of this post, it made a lot of sense. And, you know, sometimes you just gotta go all out. So
yeah,
can you tell us about the Laurent Ferrier Tourbillon Grand Sport?
Yeah, so the Tourbillon Grand Sport is obviously it's right in the name. It's a watch with a tourbillon, but the tourbillon is on the back of the, or I shouldn't say it's on the back. The tourbillon is where it would normally be in a watch with a tourbillon, but you don't see it through the front. You have to flip it over to see the tourbillon, and you know that makes it a sleeper. I think it's kind of like, that's sort of like the ultimate sleeper feature, because most of the time when you think of tourbillons, it's a, you know, that's, I don't mean this in a bad way, but it's a flex piece, you know, like you buy a tourbillon to, you know, to kind of like show off the tourbillon, you know, because it's such a difficult thing to make, and it's so rarely done. It's the sort of thing that you want to show off. And Laurent Ferrier is a brand that's and a watchmaker that's known for creating really exceptional tourbillons, and they've made it hidden. You can't see it on the dial side. So very under the radar, definitely a sleeper, and it's sort of like an FU watch without like being an FU watch in a way, because you have to flip it over to say FU, which maybe makes it even more satisfying if you're a Laurent Ferrier customer. I don't know. I'm not a not in that league at this point in my life, but it's just a really cool watch, and I think that a hidden tourbillon is definitely something that I wanted to include on this list. There are other options. Patek makes at least one watch in their catalog right now with a tourbillon that you don't see from the dial side, so it's not completely unheard of, but I think this is a pretty cool looking watch anyway, and I'm glad we were able to feature it in the guide.
Yeah, it's an interesting looking watch. Like I feel like in terms of Laurent Ferrier's, which once again, like you, I am not a customer of, I prefer perhaps some of their more classic non-sport pieces aesthetically, but they pulled off the integrated bracelet Genta-esque sport watch quite well. Yeah. There's this real sleekness to it I kind of appreciate, but frankly, we're not here for the dial side of it or the case. Right. Like we're here for that lone middle finger in the case back. No, but it is such a cool idea of like, it really is like the ultimate flex, because it is like, you know, it's there. You kind of want people to know, but you don't want people to know. It's like, you don't like only someone has to kind of earn it to know about it, you know, something like that. There must be at least one watch out there that has no tourbillon visible from the dial and a closed case back.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting thing to look into. I mean, obviously, tourbillons have been made for much longer than, it's been customary to put transparent case backs on a watch. So, they have to be out there. It's
certainly in pocket watch form, but yeah, I wonder if a wristwatch, which case it's like, don't even mention my tourbillon, please.
Yeah. I mean, how would you even know as a buyer that it had a tourbillon? You have to take it to a watchmaker to make sure that the $100,000 you just dropped was worth it, because how you don't know.
Very true. Very true. Yeah. All right. So that kind of wraps up the guide that we had written. I mean, there's a few more on here, but go, check it out for yourself. I think there's a lot to enjoy in this list, but we figured for the sake of making the podcast a little different, maybe we would, talk about a couple of our just other choices. So,
yeah.
Zach, what's a sleeper that didn't make it to the list that you're interested in?
So I want to talk about a watch that I'm actually currently writing about for Worn and Wound. The review of this watch will go up. If you're listening to this podcast on the day it comes out, it'll be up shortly, by the end of the week. And that's the Ophion Velos. And specifically, I wanted to talk about the Ophion Velos as a sleeper in the sense that it has ties to a very kind of like elite watchmaker, and that in this case is Kari Voutilainen. And another watch that we included on the list is the Souf Helsinki 180, which is tied to Stepan Sarpaneva, another very well regarded independent watchmaker. And the Ophion kind of is to me a sleeper in a number of ways, but definitely in that way, in that it's something kind of like with the fingerprints of a watchmaker that is just frankly like out of the price range, out of the not an option for like most watch consumers. And it represents a way to kind of like to get in to that watchmaker in an interesting way. And the fact that that it doesn't have the maker's name on the dial is in some ways even cooler than than a watch that does have the maker's name on the dial. Another example of this is the Chrono watches by Hajime Asayoka, another fantastic independent watchmaker. The Chrono series is his kind of like, they're not mass produced because they're all like very limited, but they're much more affordable, enthusiast focused watches. So that's kind of like an interesting subcategory all in its own, these watches.
So that
I think is an interesting sleeper watch, and there'll be much more about that watch in the in the review on Worn and Wound, but just a really impressive watch all around, and really, really cool movement, and the manufacturing of the watch is really interesting. So it's a sleeper in a number of ways, but I wanted to specifically highlight the Kari Voutilainen connection, as his case making outfit is responsible for the case of this watch.
That's very cool, and that's a cool aspect of it to highlight, because there's actually, like I said, there's kind of a lot you could highlight with that watch. And why it would fit into being a sleeper watch, and we'll certainly, I think we talked about the watch a little bit before, but we'll cover it again once your review is out. But yeah, having worn the watch a little bit and photographed it, that case, which is a very, it's an exotic case shape with the, like the teardrop lugs. It's not something I would personally like think I would find very appealing, or at least my style, I should say that, find my style. But when I actually put that watch on, I was really taken by it. And it's, yeah, you know, the same quality of the manufacturing is why it even works in the first place, because it is a complicated case with soldering and polishing, and it's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in the process of actually talking about this, I came up with several as we were sitting here. I just kept being reminded of a few. And now I'm kind of like, I don't know which one to pick, but I feel like I got to pick one. So for the sake of just adding a new brand to the list, because some of them were duplicates from what we had before, I'm going to go with the Oris Caliber 112.
Oh, so, okay, good choice.
You know, at a glance, this watch has a lot going on, so it's not necessarily a sleeper in the sense that you can tell there's complexity to it, but I think just in the reality of what it actually is and what it does and its price point, it is very cool. So, you know, the Oris Caliber 110 was their was the first iteration of their 10-day in-house manual wound movement, which it came out with several years ago, and it was a kind of a big, it was and still is a very big deal for the Oris brand, because it was kind of part of their, back in the, there's the whole like story of Oris is actually very interesting, but they used to manufacture their own calibers during the quartz crisis. They very quickly were part of the kind of the group that consolidated the Swiss watch industry, which eventually became Swatch. They got out of that because they did not want to make quartz watches, like, period. They've never produced a quartz watch. So they bolted from that to continue with mechanical movements, but have only recently, in the last several years, gotten back into actually manufacturing movements. So it was a very big deal for the brand. And of course, they didn't want to just make any ordinary movement. So they made a 10-day caliber, which, you know, the last biggest power reserve we talked about was 5-day, so this is double that. And when you look at this watch from the back, you can see about half of it is a barrel, so it's really, which is really cool. Like, that's just, you know, just a massive spring there. And they always have a power reserve on the dial, which is a unique power reserve in that it's a non-linear power reserve, so it expresses essentially how the power is actually released from the coil, and that it's slower at first, and or maybe it's the opposite, it might be faster for slower at the end. Either way, if you look at it.
Yeah, it doesn't happen at the same rate throughout the entire power reserve.
Exactly. So that's cool that it's illustrated there. And so the Caliber 112 then, kind of like every year, maybe every 2 years for a little while, they were releasing a new variation of the movement, essentially with like more complications to it. And they did quite a few. I mean, they've covered a lot of things. They haven't had a chronograph or something like that, but they have a couple of calendar complications. And this one is their GMT, or their really, a dual time watch. And it's really cool because it has three sub-dials on the dial. One is that power reserve I spoke about before. One is a sub-seconds kind of off at like 7.5, which is kind of funky. And then at 12 is a whole second time dial. So you have a whole second, hour hand and a minute hand, and then also like an AM PM indicator. And that's all independently set. So it really is a true dual time watch, which is just incredibly cool. And then you have a date over at 9. So like, this is an incredibly full featured watch that, I mean, it's two watches in one with a 10-day power reserve. And it's $6,600, so it's not inexpensive, but once again, that's a hell of a lot of movement and complication at that price point. So
yeah, that's great. No, their extended power, their standard power reserve watches are wild. I'm always interested to see what they come up with, year to year as they introduce new kind of iterations of that, and they've done a lot of really interesting things, and that's one of my personal favorites too. It's a very cool watch.
Yeah, I wish it's in a 43-millimeter case. That's the one sort of drawback. It is a sizable watch. Granted, it has a lot going on the dial. I have tried these out though, and it's like a very curvaceous case. So it feels a little bit smaller than that, but I mean, to get that level of complication, I think it's worth it. You know, because you want the dial real estate.
Yeah, definitely.
So I have others, but let's just call it. There's a lot of sleeper watches out there. You probably have some in your collection. We could keep going. I mean, maybe the System 51 is a sleeper watch. We didn't even think about that. Is it?
I mean, it could. Yeah, no, definitely could be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about sleeper watches is that it, you can kind of like make a case that almost anything is a sleeper watch if you, you know, depending on like what you find interesting about it. And I think that's one of the cool things about like putting this guide together and this conversation is that, you know, it kind of like forces you to think about like what is interesting to you about a watch and like what a watch really kind of like brings to the table. So, I'd be interested to see what listeners, you know, what their favorite sleeper watches are in the, you know, in the comments on this post. I hope we get, you know, some interesting suggestions and, you know, things to look at because it's a pretty cool, you know, category of watches.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's something we can definitely revisit, at some point in the future. Maybe we'll give it a little bit of time, you know, I think it's as, you know, talking about this is kind of shown me also that these brands are, or more brands are developing interesting movements and using interesting materials and frankly doing things that are more interesting. And as that kind of continues, so will the amount of sneaky little sleeper watches.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you for listening.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.